You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Lisa Smith. She shares a very personal story about a change she made in her relationship with her son. What you'll want to know about this conversation is that we talk about addiction or substance use disorder and the impact on a family that it has and how Lisa navigated that with her actual relationship with her son. We talk about her experience with her own son, with the therapy modalities that they tried, and how she got to the point where she made the decisions that she did, what that meant for her life, for the family. And we also talk about the pressure and judgment that parents face. This is a serious topic. I hope you'll find that I did a good job making it an interesting conversation. I think you'll agree that it is definitely a topic worth talking about. So I'll stop yapping and let's get to it. Lisa Smith, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm so happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat?
So ready. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. So I start all of my conversations asking people what part of the world they call home. Where are you?
I am in the beautiful state of Colorado. I live south of Denver, against the foothills of Pikes Peak.
Fantastic. One more warm-up question before we dive into the topic of the day. I change these up every once in a while because I hope they are interesting to the people listening, but me asking the same question over and over again, I get this urge to change it up. You're the first person to get this question. Lucky you. All right, Lisa, what is your favorite way to transition from a busy time to downtime?
That is a great question. Probably taking my dogs for a walk, just sort of without my phone, so that I kind of remind my brain that I don't always have to be working and I can transition into non-work time.
Beautiful answer. I love that. That's hard to do, leave the phone at home in modern times. First of all, it feels like you've, you know, lopped off an appendage. And then there's just the mind chatter of like, oh my gosh, is it really okay? So that's so funny. All right, topic of the day, not how hard it is to leave the cell phone at home. We are going to talk about your experience loving somebody in your life who is actively engaged in addiction, substance use, misuse. Sometimes I get to talk to people about warm and fuzzy topics, and today's topic has the potential to be serious. Let's start at the beginning with a simple question. What's the relationship that you have to the person who we're talking about today?
So my oldest son has struggled with mental health and substance use.
All right. So that's who we're talking about. And that's the dynamic, parent-child. And so that everybody is clued in. Okay. So you shared with me on the intake form, and you and I have had the chance to talk before, that it was a cold day in Colorado, and your son left the house, and you experienced a realization that he might die, and you were not okay with the last thing that he saw, felt, and heard from you. So do you remember how long ago that particular incident was? Like, how long are we talking?
Yeah, I do. It was, about 8 years ago. He was an in between adolescence and young adulthood. He was like a early young adult and late adolescent. It was a rough day.
That is, all things aside, like mental health and substance use aside, that's an interesting part of the parenting journey because I equate it to teaching somebody how to ride a bike and taking the training wheels off, right? Like there are times that young adults that age are supposed to and even sometimes required to do things on their own, but they also sometimes want and need us in their life as parents. And it's, you know, it's a really, really interesting thing. Like they can do many, many things on their own. And then you say like, hey, call the doctor's office. And they're like, I don't know how to do that. And you're like, okay, moving on. It's a really interesting time. All right. So you used the description of him being an active addiction. I threw in some additional words that I've heard before. Do you have an estimate to share with us how long you and your family had been aware of the struggles? Like, did you become aware of it just 8 years ago or had it been going? How long had you been living with this before this incident that came to a head?
Yeah. several years, a few years, really from, his entire high school time period, we knew that he was struggling. And like most things that accelerate into really scary things, it started as what would probably appear somewhat normal, typical, maybe not normal, but typical struggle, experimentation, stretching the parameters of what's okay, and accelerated throughout those 3 or 4 years prior to sort of the event.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing when we're dealing with kids that are making decisions, because the description of a kid who is really outside the lines and the description of a kid who is inside the mainstream lines, they're very similar. It is hard, I think, to actually tell the difference sometimes. Like, is this normal boundary testing adolescence growing up, or is something very, very wrong? Because adolescents do things like sleep really bizarre hours. Is there something wrong, or is this normal? And people joke about the weird things that healthy teenagers do. And so it makes it hard, in my experience, unrelated to yours, it makes it hard to figure out, like, hey, is this normal and everything is fine, or is this where we raise our hand and say something is up? And so I just want to call that out and say that, I think it's a tough time to be an adult. I do. And I don't think this was different 50 years ago, probably. I think there were different challenges, but I mean, the challenge of raising adolescents is just epically famous for how hard it is. So at the time of this one event, was your son still predominantly living at home? And do you want to give us a bigger, broader picture of some of the complexities of the situation overall? Because you weren't living in a vacuum where you were examining things under a microscope for this one child.
No, he had, it was clear that he had a substance use disorder diagnosis.
Okay, so you are aware.
We were aware. He had gone actually to multiple treatment attempts at that time, even at his young age. Like, we knew things accelerated very quickly with him, and we knew that he was in crisis for, it had been a couple years already. And he was living in our home, because we felt like we could save him, have influence on him. We didn't know where else he would go. And that is, it was a disaster. We were damaging him. He was damaging us. Our home was damaged. There was no positive that was occurring because we just did not have support to be able to support him in a way that was appropriate.
So at this point, when he walks out and you have this, I'm calling it a gut check moment. Tell us a little bit how you would score this parent-child relationship in terms of connection and stress, like on a 1 to 10 scale, with 10 being besties who are showing up to parties in matching outfits and 1 being severely strained and super tough. Where were you guys weighing in?
Right, one or below, for
At this,
sure. I mean, we were existing in the same like square of a home.
you're
We
sharing the same space.
did not have a relationship that had any positive communication either direction. And the stress was extremely huge, and the trauma was giant.
Wow, and it really, I mean, I know this was 8 years ago, and it's been a long time. It's not, this is a snapshot of a time in your life, but it's easy for me to imagine how hard it was, because when one person in a family is struggling, the whole house tends to struggle. And it's one of the things that people have studied and talk about, like how to run a house under that sort of framework. And it comes up every once in a while. And people will say things like, don't lower the temperature of the house to the person who's not performing. But in a family, It's like impossible advice. It's like, okay, we're just not going to pay attention to the person who's struggling in the room who does that with their family, right? So that's, I just think I think that, running an office or running a community center is a little different than running a house when it comes to how we interact with the people around us, especially how old they are and all those things. Okay, so he walks out. You guys are like stressed out. You're not having good connection. I'm going to assume that there were blowups and conflicts on a pretty regular basis. Was there anything specific or unusual or different that happened right before this when he walked out that made this different than another day?
Not necessarily, other than just clarity for myself. And whether, I was able to, I guess I was probably at my breaking point of sustainability. And, maybe I could see the impact of my own pain and needs through his eyes differently. I mean, there wasn't words that were exchanged that were different. There wasn't anything different other than this is my moment of surrender and realizing that I had to change something.
Okay, all right. So you were realizing that this is the time that you had to change something for you. And this is a moment that you came to clarity and realization. You have the distance of time and experience to be able to look back on it. Do you have an inkling about what is it about this moment necessarily or this experience that made it the straw that pushed you into change? Like what do you think was different than this, with this explosion, with this fight, than any of the fights that had happened before?
I think it's when you're in the crisis, when you're in the chaos, and when you're talking about drug and alcohol use, it's dangerous. People die. And when you're in that, when you're like close to the fire of that, it's really hard to see the bigger picture. And, you're looking at small details that are important details, but they aren't the problem. And when you can step back, which is exactly what just whatever, for whatever reason, that moment provided me, then you can all of a sudden see sort of the umbrella bigger picture of these distracting details of danger, of fear, of behavior, they're a problem, but they weren't the problem. And stepping back allowed me to be able to go, hang on a second. These things, these little things that they're big things, but these details of behavior that I'm hyper focused on are going to kill him. That is going to happen. There's only a couple directions this can go: out, prison, or dying. I mean, that's just where it leads. And stepping away from that fear allowed me to be able to say, hang on a second. There's a person here that is important, and I want to show up differently for that person because I can't change the details. I've tried. I've tried all of that stuff. I've tried the you need to's till the cows came home, and then you need to's were not working. So how can I create a connection to the person, and have radical acceptance for how the details were going to play out?
Oh, so it's radical acceptance. That's a whole other problem. I mean, it's part of this conversation, but it's definitely a whole other topic. And for anybody who's listening who does not know what that is, I think it was first coined, maybe, I don't know if she gets credit for it, but Tara Brach wrote a book called Radical Acceptance. And there's a movement and all of these things. And it's one of the tools for releasing things that we cannot control. All right, so I'm going to take a second and talk directly to the audience. I'm talking to Lisa Smith about her experience and a change she made in a relationship with her young adult son. And I invite you to the conversation. I post a discussion question on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Pop on over, join us in the comments. It's super fun. If you're not connected with us on social media, the social accounts are in the show notes, of course. All right, back to where we were, Lisa. All right, so you describe this change as shifting from trying to fix him to loving him. And so, in order to understand the transition and the change for people who might be wondering kind of what that looks like in practical terms, can we talk a little bit about what the fixing him, changing him work looked like before? And so, I ask you this. I want to just add this in here. When I ask this, it's more about giving an example for people who are listening to identify in their own situation, and definitely not anything about judgment, or thoughts about the quality of what those decisions were before, if that makes any
Totally.
sense. Okay. All right. So give us some examples of what trying to fix him or trying to fix the situation looked like in your sort of situation.
So on a bigger scale, it's really entering all the relational conversations with an agenda. So curiosity with expectation, questions with an understanding of what the correct answer was. So for example, who are you going out with? Was asking to be lied to. I don't know what else I was looking for other than to be lied to, because the answer was not what I wanted to hear, and he knew it. So there was a big disconnect. Or going into every single conversation with, this needs to change, and I've got an expectation for what that change needs to look like. Are you ready for help? Do you want to engage with a therapist, a psychiatrist, a treatment center, whatever, right? Like, how many recovery meetings have you attended this week? There's expectations in all of those questions. I might think that they sound curious, but they're curious to ease my discomfort. They're not actually curious to understand the human being that was in front of me. So that's what fixing sort of looks like.
Okay, so this is when, so you wake up and instead of having a conversation, like as you're curious, like, hey, did you have a good time last night? A conversation, you're asking questions like, well, who were you with?
Right. What did
Where
you?
did you go?
Yeah.
Right. And you're on guard.
And I already know the answers.
Oh, and
Like,
you already know these. So, because that's one of those things where, curiosity, that same question could just be curious, hey, was the neighbor there? Is there
right.
a, right? And I think that also, I'll ask this as a follow-up question. Some of this is age appropriate because we are talking about somebody who is a young adult. And so there is a shift. Like if you're talking to a 6-year-old,
Right.
those are young children and they need guidance in making the decisions. And so it's a different discussion. But as, and this is not an easy change for a lot of people, myself included, to make sometimes to acknowledge that when people go from being young children to being adults, they actually get to decide these things and our input doesn't matter. That's a tough one, right?
Right. In fact, your input might actually push them in the direction that you don't want them to go.
Yeah, no, definitely. I definitely went through a season of my life where if my parents had one opinion, they were like, you should take this class. I was like, I'm going to take the exact opposite. Thank you for your opinion. So definitely some folks go through that. So I think I think that was helpful in illustrating it. Okay, so then did you make this shift? Let's talk about how you got to be able to make this shift. You have shared with us that you guys were working on this. It sounds like very hard as a family unit. You were looking for support resources. You had gone through various rehabilitation programs, and it's not, I'm going to guess you had an army of therapists and doctors that you tried over time. Did you get to this shift of releasing the fixing personality on your own? Or was this something that people had been encouraging you to do? Were there other, was it something that was in around that you were like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do this?
Yeah, alone. And that's unfortunate. The modalities and support that is out there for families who are trying to tread these waters is does not feel, or did not to me, feel supportive. It's really hard to tell a mom that she needs to detach with love. That's a phrase that is in a very popular support structure for families that I take issue with. Detachment is not love. Stepping back with a different lens to step back in the relationship in a different way, that can be loving. That doesn't mean you have to be sweet. It just means that you're actually wanting to engage in the relationship. So what was offered to families is hold your breath and wait for them to, hit rock bottom or, spin out, and you have no power. And if you're trying to have power, you're actually codependent and enabling, which are two words that I don't use in my current work with families. But that's not helpful to a mom who's afraid their child is going to die. That's not helpful. Those aren't helpful words.
Yeah. I think I probably do use that, like the words loving and detachment in the same sentence sometimes. And when I am saying, when I use it, I don't use, I'm not with a substance use context, but the thing that has been helpful to me is to make the decisions I make about engaging from a loving position. And that helps me see whether or not I want to interject and be in the conflict, or whether or not, like my agenda is this is loving. So like, I'll use an out of context example with a little kid. The kid doesn't want to do the homework. Me jumping in and saying, hey, it's homework time, is out of hopefully love for the kid and the situation, right? Now, if the kid is like having an absolute meltdown tantrum and their relationship is falling apart, the loving decision is like, maybe homework doesn't have to be done right now.
Yeah.
Like the relationship. So, as opposed to, like, I think what you're saying, and tell me, correct me if I'm wrong, choosing to detach and disengage often means to remove yourself from the situation.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. And
Also
when
permission
you,
to not
yeah.
look at yourself, right?
Yeah.
It's permission to sort of call the problem something else.
Yeah.
Not look at yourself as part of the solution. And when what you were describing, Amy, is really important. And obviously, I'm not talking about young children. Young
Right,
children,
which is why I keep using them as an example because it's
they don't
easier
have
to, yeah. Yeah.
this. Like, there's zero out of all the children have that. So hopefully, but being able to step aside and say, who do I want to be in this relationship? How do I want to be received? That's not detachment. That's actually a very deep connection with self so that you can engage differently. And so that word detach, I think, gives people permission to problems you, problems over
Yeah.
here, and I'm going to go over here and distract myself as opposed to doing some personal work so that I can love somebody better.
Yeah. So one of when I was really trying to learn about disengagement, and then they go, they're kissing cousins, disengagement and detachment. They're two, they can be two stages of a conversation. I was working with my stepkids and I was like, I don't understand what to do. And they're like, well, walk away. If you can't handle the situation, you can physically remove yourself. Don't engage. Don't respond and walk away. And it was such an epic failure because you know what happened, Lisa? This young child just followed me into the next room. And I was like, well, that wasn't, that didn't help at all. And it,
But as you were saying that story, though, I was thinking to myself, the most effective way is to actually first look at yourself and say, what is it that I need? I need a minute to think about how I want to engage with this young person. So actually stating that, even to a young child, can be
yes.
really effective. I need 5 minutes to get a glass of water, walk around the house so that I can talk to you in a way that I'm proud of. And
Yeah.
that person, however young or old, can learn to respect that. And the second piece of that is you're modeling to them healthy, appropriate engagement and self-care.
Yeah, and when you throw in anything else that complicates it, then these things don't always work. So I share this story all the time with people. I followed up with a kid who was out later than I expected. This is a teenager, right? And I was like, hey, where are you kind of thing. And I was just checking in, proof of life, please, and then I said, hey, why don't you come home? And it escalated into like a late night non-productive fight. And we laugh about it because the whole time I kept saying, this is not a good time to have the conversation. I'd really just love to like end this. It's not productive. Let's talk about it tomorrow. And I was trying to like get out of it and not engage because it wasn't going well. And it did like the other person would not drop it. And I was like, and then the next day when we came back together, I was like, so anyway, would have been better if we hadn't had the middle of the night fight, eh? It just, you add anything, fatigue, mental illness, stress, intoxication, the techniques that might work in a vacuum, in a perfect scenario, or that look like they work in a book, or that feel like they're going to work in the therapist room, I find that sometimes in real life, they're a little harder to apply. That's all I'm saying. I don't know if you have that experience. You have, like, so or not, Lisa. All right. So you did not get this push from the therapist that you were working from. So how did you find your way to making this decision to step into loving him, and then how did it impact your relationship?
So, I mean, I had to get pretty quiet with myself, which was hard, right? Like, who have I become in this disorder? And who do I want to be in the relationship? And so, really doing a lot of my own soul searching of, is it possible for me to separate the behaviors that are really hard to love and love the person? And so I just really focused on that, which wasn't loving as much as I wanted to. It wasn't fixing, it wasn't, bringing him back into a healthy mindset. It was just connecting, and then realizing that, oh, he wants that, and continuing to grow those connections. And then ultimately, through research, through my own research, found that there is a lot of data and there is a lot of science behind, and I knew this. I was a teacher for 23 years. How do people learn? How do we motivate people to want better for themselves, to get that internal motivation? I knew the answers to this, but there is a lot of data around when family systems start getting healthy for themselves, not for the other person. There's an invitation that's available to the other person, and it has an exponential rate of success compared to, well, let it ride. Hopefully this ends well.
Okay.
That
So,
route doesn't, the numbers aren't good.
yeah. So you got quiet with yourself. You did a lot of research. You were in the lab of your family, the experiment lab of your family. Like, this was actually happening in real time. And so your background is as a teacher. And then your experience with this was like actual in your face, hands. Boots on the ground, like this is your life. It was like you're trying to make it work in your life. Did you have any background in counseling, substance use, any of these things before you were thrust into this in your family?
No, I mean, my background is in educational philosophy and motivational, internal motivation building,
Okay.
which you could argue is exactly what you said, just with the goal of people learning information rather than learning about self-exploration.
Okay, all right. So I'm going to ask you an unrelated question just because one of the precepts, one of the concepts behind this show is that I'm working to elevate the voices of people who have actual experience, like lived experience, to be heard along with, like, and valued and seen as important along with experience with advice and wisdom from people who are traditionally considered, professionals or experts within a category. Because I don't think that they always align exactly the same. And I think that it can be really helpful to, I mean, listen, I'm not throwing the experts out with the bathwater here. I'm a really big fan in going to experts for advice. It's just that I think that it's a different story when you talk to somebody who's walked the walk. And so there's a difference between talking to somebody who's working as a therapist as a job with people who are struggling with substance use and talking to a parent who's lived it is the thing. So, did you find that, I went so far into that that I lost my question in there. But the thing is, did you find that what your experience was differed from the advice, and that it was hard to find people to talk to and find and connect with other people who are going through the experience and willing to talk about it and share their experiences with you?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there are, and it's becoming more popular. I think because so many families are just demanding a different, just a different process or a different help, a different type of help. But yes, there is, like I said, there's research, there's data, there's science behind family system support. And how to support families to engage differently with loved ones who are struggling with substance use or just challenging behaviors. Like it kind of runs the gamut. And you have to dig deep to find it. And some of it is because there's reasons. It's not covered by insurance.
Okay.
It's not recognized by, what in our society, I guess, just makes decisions about, mental health effectiveness. So it's not covered by insurance. So it's not kind of driven with that. Also, it's not actionable for professionals dealing with people who are the person of concern, the person with the struggle, with the behaviors that are concerning. They don't have the professionals don't have the bandwidth to include now a crisis-driven fat, family system that is high demand. Like they're
Oh,
trying
yeah.
to help the person that is in quote unquote crisis, that whose behaviors are the most dangerous, that we need to help them right now. That's the triage. And then there's this like outskirt family system, which can be large and have its own set of baggage that they bring along, and needs and demands and handholding that they need. And so it's really hard to actually provide that support in the container that we have in our systems. It's kind of not built in.
So let me see. I'm going to ask a follow-up question. And let me see if I understand what you're saying. If based on that, the person who is the client or the patient or the person who's in crisis, is not the same as their supporting family unit. And like often, the people who the person who needs the help who's in crisis may not actually be asking for help. It's the external family and somebody else who's asking for it. And then you have a situation, especially if it's an adult, and you see this often in portrayed in TV shows about mental health and things like that. It's like the supporting people in the family are raising their hand. They're like, this person needs help. But there's not the medical system is like, sorry, it's not you. Then you almost feel like you have to wait until like something horrible happens,
Yes.
and the rest of the people are all around very powerless, saying, "But we're trying to get we don't want to wait until the horrible thing happens. We want support." And it's what I hear you saying is, unfortunately, the reality is that no, the system that we currently have is not designed to support that scenario.
Correct, correct. And so we want to help this person get support. Also, we are hurting and nobody
Yeah.
understands why they're actually putting blame, and they're telling us to stop hurting, but this is really hurtful. So I don't know how to stop hurting when there's a broken person in my system that I care about dramatically. There's a Desmond Tutu quotation that I will not get 100% correct, but you can find it, which alludes to we need to stop pulling people out of the river. We need to start going up the river and figuring out why they're falling in. And
Yeah.
that quotation just to me exemplifies the mental health crisis that we have in our country. We've got support professionals at the end of this flood of people who need help, and they come to that help generally in crisis, like
Yeah.
actual. And if we went up the river a little bit, there's families saying, I'll learn. And because they see what's coming, they can see what's going to happen. And I think if we started to include the willing participants before the people who ended up in crisis, we might not need to wait for that crisis.
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting. So, and anybody who's listening who's ever tried to find a psychiatrist or a psychotherapist, often the offices are full. They're absolutely full. They're not taking any patients, and you almost feel like you can't get in until something happens. Even if you know, and so if you've got a kid who's like experiencing, school refusal or anxiety and things like that, and people are encouraging you to go find support, it can be really, really hard to find. And I think that is an exact example of what you're talking about. They're not designed to intervene until there is a crisis, and unfortunately, that means you're at crisis as opposed to intervention before a crisis happens, which is sad. Very, very. I wish that I had a magic wand to change that. Let's talk. You mentioned the shame and the stigma as a parent of somebody who is struggling. Did you experience, and do you want to talk a little bit about the really public-facing pressure that parents of children and adults experience when your kid is doing something that society says is not, Pinterest ready?
Yeah, it's not Pinterest ready. Good one.
Yeah.
It's definitely not. Yeah, it's tough. You really, there isn't a meal train for this. Like, people don't show
Oh, yeah.
up and support you. In fact, they step back as if they can catch it. And that's not helpful. You do learn really quickly who can sit with hard things. Which ones of your friends have the empath capacity to just be present in what is hard and realize that this is not something you did wrong. This is a human experience that your family is having. And for people to hold space for that is it's tricky. It's really hard. And you see really quickly who can and most people can't.
Yeah, there are so many situations. So you said something there that I'm going to expand at because there's so many situations. There's millions of situations where something will happen, and your first inclination is to turn it inward and say, "This means I've done something wrong." And almost always, that is not the case. Like, it's such a more helpful thing to say something has gone wrong, and what do I want to do next? Because that action of like internalizing it and being like, I'm not a good enough mother, I'm not a good enough wife, I'm not a good enough employee, that actually, in a lot of times, can keep us in a spot where we're not working on fixing the problem. Like, we're just stewing in, and I call it the knowledge trap. That's where you can spin out and be like, well, if I just learn enough about how to do this thing, then I can fix it. And, often it's not, like it doesn't work. And so that I heard you say that, and I wanted to call that out. In my experience, that's one of those things that it's like, learn to hear yourself saying it and be like, wait, is this really me? Or is this something else? Like, which I don't think is easy to do.
It's a bigger and it goes beyond that. I mean, that's really touching the just starting to touch the problem and kind of giving yourself permission to have this experience. But it goes to a more societal, cultural, community-driven mindset of connecting a person to the problem. And instead of being able to say this person has a problem and separating problem as a separate entity. This is, again, I said it before, a human experience. This is something that someone is experiencing. And when you're talking about particularly substance use, so many of us connect it to a choice. And there is a level of choice involved in substance use. And I like to say it goes from choice to not choice. And some people's brains don't have a choice in that middle section to choice to leave. And it's a really hard choice at that point because your brain has been hijacked. So if you can start separating, even with yourself, I didn't do anything wrong. I'm experiencing this and it's hard. You can start looking at your loved one in that way too. We've all made choices that we would over and do differently. Some of us got lucky, and some of us didn't get lucky in certain circumstances. And if we can separate that person who is having a hard experience from the level of choice that they made to get into it, we can actually get them help before it's a crisis. But if we keep connecting the person to the behavior, they're sitting in their shame cave until it's an absolute crisis. So necessary.
And it does, and it's, I'll reverse this because that first you said, separate the person from, your thoughts about the person from the behaviors and the actions they're doing, which I first heard that when I was surrounded by little kids, when we were talking about like squeezing the juice box and fighting with siblings and stuff like that. So that's the first time I heard that as a parenting tool. And you and it's a lot easier to do when you're talking about the juice box than bigger things. So, but it does, it is a very powerful message. And then I think that just giving weight to the fact that society does judge parents and moms based on the behavior of their kids. And it's not fair. Right. It's really not fair. And yet it happens all the time. Like, so, when your kids do well in school, people come up and congratulate you as if you did the homework, and it's like so weird. And then, when they don't do well, they come and they're like, well, fix it. And it's like, okay, yeah, then you want to come over and say, it's like, I'm not the one doing the homework, But it is, it's a, it, I just want to throw that out there that it is a really, really valid thing that the pressure and the judgment that we perceive. Because you'd like to be able to say like, oh, well, it doesn't matter. No, it matters a lot. It matters a lot in how you're going through things. All right, so I could talk to you about this all day, but you go through this shift. You shift from working on fixing him to really focusing on loving him. And today you have turned that into a consulting business that you call Parallel Recovery, and you have a new book out, which is really exciting. Do you want to take a minute and talk to us about what this is and what it became and how people can find the book?
So I've created basically sort of a philosophy approach. And if I pare it down to just the foundation, it's sustainability for the family system, for the family members who are affected. How do I keep engaging in what, I mean, when we're talking, the brain is attached to the body. Brain disorders are disorders of the body. They are diseases of the body. Just like other chronic or reoccurring illnesses, there's not in necessarily an end game to the struggle that your person's going to have. That doesn't mean we have to get to crisis, but they will continue to have challenges in their life related to this topic. So, how do I sustain that? How do I keep showing up and kind of ride the waves? And how do I connect so that my love actually invites them to want better, so that my voice starts being the voice of reason as opposed to other voices that might not have their well-being in mind like I do as a mom. And so that's it, sustainability and connection. And through those kind of foundational tools, it's some self-work, stepping out of the crisis in at hand and looking at this from a bigger lens. And looking at myself, how have I engaged in this problem? How do I want to engage with the person? All of that kind of stuff. Who do I want to be? Psychoeducation around what happens when our brains are challenged with mental health and or substance use. It's under the same umbrella. And then finally, how do you communicate and behave in ways that are effective? For example, going back to your example about, needing a minute from the temper tantrum in front of you, rather than just walking away and having that person follow you around the house, actually sort of speak it in a way that's saying, this is what I need, reflection. This is what I'm going to give myself, and here's how I'm going to give it. And also, you're important to me, so I'm going to come back around as soon as I'm at a place where I can have a conversation that I can feel proud of. So it's kind of, I really like to think of it as learning a ton of tools, sticking them in your toolbox, and then situationally figuring out what tools do I need to activate or grab onto today? Because it's not just a one size fits all situation. Where are you in your own personal growth journey? Where are you in your own mental health challenges or strength right now? Where is your loved one in terms of needing boundaries or being ready for more closer agreements or collaborations? Like the tools are not just in this situation use these languages, but how can you show up in a way that is most effective and most sustainable for all the people?
Very nice. It sounds like it's a lot of work, but that's I mean, that's the truth in so many things. We wish for a magic wand or an instant solution that changes one thing forever. But so many, and sometimes that's what it is. When you get strep throat, you can go to the doctor, they write you a prescription, it goes away. So many things in adulting, parenting, these are, long things that we're doing continuously. There's a joke about fitness. Like, fitness is like blowing into a balloon that has a hole in it. It's like you don't just get to do it and stop. You've just got to keep doing it. And nobody likes to hear that. So, all right, show us the book and tell us where people can find the book.
Yeah, the book is awesome. It's called Parallel Recovery, a guide for those who love someone with substance use disorder. And you can pre-order it today, pre-order it. When this comes out, it will be on order at Amazon. Just look at Parallel Recovery and it's there.
All right, and I'll put a link to the book in the show notes so people can get that. And for anybody who's subscribed to the Imperfect Adulting email list, that's the easiest way to grab the link. So you don't have to like try, especially with an Amazon link, which is like a series of letters and numbers and symbols. Then it just zips into your email box and you can click on it. Of course, you are all able to do your own online searches. You're very competent. Lisa, I want to thank you for sharing all of that with the audience. Are you ready for the final fun three questions?
Ready.
All right, let's do it. Have you ever solved a Rubik's Cube?
No. One side only.
One side only. Very good.
Have to
All
be real.
right. All right. When you're bored and there's no Wi-Fi or cell service, what's something you might do to fill the time?
Well, I took up knitting several years ago. And so I will probably pull out one of my several projects that I have going at any given time.
What is something like, do you knit like blankets, or are you able to do things like sweaters and socks, and what are the things you do?
Yeah, I always have a sock going because they're portable. So there's
Okay.
always a sock on needles. I have sweaters. So I
Wow.
do sweaters, I do baby gifts. I have yarn for a blanket, but I've actually not ever done a blanket, maybe because it's just sort of back and forth knitting.
Yeah.
I have a poncho that I'm working on right now. A lot of beanies. I'm really into hats. Colorado, I sort of am under the belief that you can't have too many hats. I don't understand. I know you don't live in a state where you
Right,
probably.
exactly. No, this is the reason I have this question. So I went through a season where I did baby blankets as a gift, and then when that expired, I was like, "Oh, I could do." And I was like, "Well, I don't, it's never below 75 degrees here. Like, there's less use for, a sweater or a beanie or a blanket or even socks, wool socks." So like, I was like, "I need a different hobby." All right. On a holiday or a special occasion, if you get to choose a special dessert for yourself, what would you pick? Would it be cookies, cake, ice cream, fancy cheeses, or something else? Like, what's your favorite?
Well, I'm gluten-free, so as much as I would love to choose cake and cookies, that's just frankly they're not good. So I'm gonna go with the savory and say cheeses with like a good like fig jam and maybe a rice cracker. Like that to me is very satiating and yummy.
And a big treat. That is it. Thank you so much, Lisa, for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.